And again, the actual document which we obtained was identical in every respect to the document in the book, except for a file number at the bottom of the second page, mostly scratched out, which did not appear in the novel. Obviously, again, if someone for some reason was trying to establish a clever forgery, they could have stuck that on as well. However, again, from the network of personal associations, it is our belief that this is, in fact, a real document, and we're going to cite, we're going to talk about that some more in just a second. You want to stick something in, Nip?
I'll wait till you finish.
The point being that, again, you know, it is within the realm of possibility for someone with the resources to have forged a very clever forgery. One wonders what the motivation might have been on the part of those interests. However, the main point is, and there are other indications that elements of our national security establishment would think along these lines, our work on Jonestown and other things would indicate that this is by no means a fantastic possibility. The fact of the matter is now, though, in contemplating the King Alfred plan, that it is obvious that the subject matter of this memorandum, we believe it's real. Our confidants have told us it's real. Some might argue with that, but the fact of the matter is that the plan it details, obviously, is not only real, but is something which is very, very current. There is, in fact, as we now know from the disclosures of Rex 84 and the work of Alfonso Chardy and others, there is, in fact, just such a contingency plan within the National Security Council. Something which is perhaps apocryphal under the circumstance, but we think is worth thinking about, too, is that whether or not Rex 84, obviously Rex being the Latin word for king, could perhaps in some way relate to the King Alfred plan. King Alfred having been a very famous king of England who's credited with having turned back the Norris invaders and helped establish certain principles of English common law. I'm now going to read you the King Alfred plan. Take note of the constant reference to the emergency. Remember, this document, this contingency plan is by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and you will hear repeated references to the emergency as I read the King Alfred plan. We are now going to read you the King Alfred plan. King Alfred, in the event of widespread and continuing and coordinated racial disturbances in the United States, King Alfred, at the discretion of the President, is to be put into action immediately. Participating federal agencies: National Security Council, Central Intelligence Agency, Federal Bureau of Investigation, Department of Justice, Department of Defense, Department of Interior. Participating state agencies under federal jurisdiction: National Guard units, state police. Participating local agencies under federal jurisdiction: city police and county police. And by the way, on the origin of the name, it says, next to an asterisk, 849 through 899, King of England, directed translation from the Latin of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. Memo, National Security Council. Even before 1954, when the Supreme Court of the United States of America declared unconstitutional separate educational and recreational facilities, racial unrest and discord had become very nearly a part of the American way of life. But that way of life was repugnant to most Americans. Since 1954, however, that unrest and discord have broken out into widespread violence, which increasingly have placed the peace and stability of the nation in dire jeopardy. This violence has resulted in loss of life, limb, and property, and has cost the taxpayers of this nation billions of dollars. And the end is not yet in sight. This same violence has raised the tremendously grave question as to whether the races can ever live in peace with each other. Each passing month has brought new intelligence that, despite new laws passed to alleviate the condition of the minority, and minority is capitalized in this document, the minority still is not satisfied. Demonstrations and rioting have become a part of the familiar scene. Troops have been called out in city after city across the land, and our image as a world leader severely damaged. Our enemies press closer, seeking the advantage, possibly at a time during one of these outbreaks of violence. The minority has adopted an almost military posture to gain its objectives, which are not clear to most Americans. It is expected, therefore, that when those objectives are denied the minority, racial war must be considered inevitable. When that emergency comes, and emergency is also capitalized, we must expect the total involvement of all 22 million members of the minority, men, women, and children, for once this project is launched, its goal is to terminate, once and for all, the minority threat to the whole of American society and, indeed, the free world. Chairman, National Security Council.
Preliminary memo, Department of Interior. Under King Alfred, the nation has been divided into 10 regions. See accompanying map. In case of emergency, minority members will be evacuated from the cities by federalized National Guard units, local and state police, and if necessary, by units of the regular armed forces using public and military transportation and detained in nearby military installations until a further course of action has been decided. And then it lists the various regions here, and I would note that there are 10 of them, and I'm going to come back to that in a second. One, Capital Region, that's obviously Washington, D.C. Two, Northeast Region. Three, Southeast Region. Four, Great Lakes Region. Five, South Central Region. Six, Deep South Region. Seven, Deep South Region 2. Eight, Great Plains Rocky Mountain Region. Nine, Southwest Region. 10, A and B, West Coast Region. A being north, apparently Washington and Oregon from the map. B being down in Southern California. Then the memo goes on. No attempt will be made to seal off the Canadian and Mexican borders. Before continuing with the King Alfred plan, I'd just like to hearken back to a provision here of Rex 84. And let me go back.
Rex 84, for those of you who are in the middle of this and are trying to follow and having a little problem, Rex 84, remember, is the confirmed plan mentioned at some length in the Sheehan affidavit that was put together by Oliver North and the folks over at FEMA Management. And we're going to be reading a short segment here down in the footnotes from the Sheehan affidavit about the some interesting correspondences between Rex 84 and the putative King Alfred plan.
Right now, going from King Alfred plan back to the Sheehan affidavit, it says here, according to Rex, or it says, first, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, after deputizing all DOD personnel and state National Guard personnel, ostensibly so as to make such personnel civilians and to thereby avoid violating the congressionally enacted Posse Comitatus Act, would undertake to test its ability to seek out and to take into custody some 400,000 undocumented Central American aliens throughout the United States, and then to intern said Central American aliens in 10 military detention centers to be established during this Rex 84 readiness exercise. And in a footnote, it points out that these are to be 1, Fort Drum, New York, 2, Fort Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania, 3, Fort A.P. Hill outside of the District of Columbia in Virginia, 4, Fort Benning, Georgia, 5, Eglin Air Force Base in Florida, 6, Camp Chrome, Florida, this base to serve as the jointly FEMA INS Administration Interrogation Center, 7, Fort Chaffee in Arkansas, 8, Fort Wachuska, Arizona, which was also to serve as the U.S.-based Ground Communication Center for Operation Night Train, and 9, Eglin Air Force Base in California, and 1 outside of Oakdale, California. There is a remarkably close degree of correspondence between the 10 regional detention centers outlined under Rex 84 and the 10 regions under the King Alfred plan. Continuing with the King Alfred plan, we felt it was important to point out that unnerving similarity. Combined memo, Department of Justice, Federal Bureau of Investigation, Central Intelligence Agency. There are 12 major minority organizations, and all are familiar to the 22 million. Dossiers have been compiled on the leaders of the organizations and can be studied in Washington. The material contained in many of the dossiers and our threat to reveal that material has considerably held in check the activities of some of the leaders. Leaders who do not have such usable material in their dossiers have been approached to take government posts, mostly as ambassadors and primarily in African countries. The promise of these positions also has materially contributed to a temporary slowdown of minority activities. However, we do not expect these slowdowns to be of long duration because there are always new and dissonant elements joining these organizations with the potential power to replace the old leaders. All organizations and their leaders are under constant 24-hour surveillance. The organizations are 1, the Black Muslims, 2, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, 3, Congress of Racial Equality, 4, the Uhuru Movement, 5, the Group on Advanced Leadership, or GOAL, 6, the Freedom Now Party, 7, United Black Nationalists of America, 8, the New Pan-African Movement, 9, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, 10, the National Urban League, 11, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and 12, the Committee on Racial and Religious Progress. Note, at the appropriate time to be designated by the president, the leaders of some of these organizations are to be detained only when it is clear that they cannot prevent the emergency, working with local public officials during the first critical hours. All other leaders are to be detained at once. Compiled lists of minority leaders have been readied at the National Data Computer Center. It is necessary to use the minority leaders designated by the president in much the same manner in which we use minority members who are agents with central and federal. That, of course, interrupting refers to the CIA and FBI. And we cannot, until there is no alternative, reveal King Alfred in all its aspects. Minority members of Congress will be unseated at once. This move is not without precedent in American history. That from the Attorney General.
Continuing with the King Alfred plan from the man who cried, I am. Preliminary memo, Department of Defense. This memo is being submitted in lieu of a full report from the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That report is now in preparation. There will be many cities where the minority will be able to put into the street a superior number of people with a desperate and dangerous will. He will be a formidable enemy, for he is bound to the continent by heritage and knows that political asylum will not be available to him in other countries. The greatest concentration of the minority is in the Deep South and Eastern Seaboard, the Great Lakes region, and the West Coast. While the national population exceeds that of the minority by more than 10 times, we must realistically take into account the following. 1. An estimated 40 to 50% of the white population will not, for various reasons, engage the minority during an emergency. 2. American armed forces are spread around the world. A breakout of war abroad means fewer troops at home to handle the emergency. 3. Local law enforcement officials must contain the emergency until help arrives, though it may mean fighting a superior force. New York City, for example, has a 25,000-man police force, but there are about 1 million minority members in the city. We are confident that the minority could hold any city it took for only a few hours. The lack of weapons, facilities, logistics all put the minority at a final disadvantage. Since the Korean War, this department has shifted minority members of the armed forces to combat to areas where combat is most likely to occur, with the aim of eliminating, through combat, as many combat-trained minority servicemen as possible. Today, the ratio of minority member combat deaths in Vietnam, where they are serving as, quote, advisors, unquote, is twice as high as the minority population ratio to the rest of America. Below is the timetable for King Alfred as tentatively suggested by the JCS, Joint Chiefs of Staff, who recommend that the operation be made over a period of 8 hours. 1. Local police and minority leaders in action to head off the emergency. 2. Countdown to 8 hours begins at the moment the president determines the emergency to be A. national, B. coordinated, C. of long duration. 8th hour. 3. County police join local police in the 7th hour. In the 6th hour, state police join county and local forces. The 5th, federal marshals join state, county, and local forces. 4th, National Guards federalized, held in readiness. Regular armed forces alerted, take up positions. Minority troops divided and detained along with all white sympathizers under guard. 8. That's in the third hour, excuse me. In the second hour, all minority leaders, national and local, detained. President addresses minority on radio television, gives it 1 hour to end the emergency, the first. And then 0 hour, all units under regional commands into the emergency. Zero committee support report.
That may, but I was just wondering, that may be O committee, like O for committee. Operational committee.
You may be right. Survey shows that during a 6-year period, production created 9 million objects, or 1,500,000 each year. Production could not dispose of the containers, which proved a bottleneck. However, that was almost 20 years ago. We suggest that vaporization techniques be employed to overcome the production problems inherent in King Alfred. Signed, Secretary of Defense.
I think that last little part there, the O Committee report, might be worth rereading, Nip, just because it's so cheap. It doesn't strike one at first. And I think listeners should listen very carefully to the language here. The units they're talking about are black people.
And they're talking, the production that they're talking, they're referring to production of 20 years before, and we all know what this is, supposedly is something written in the mid-60s, 20 years before that, of course, being during World War II, production being incapable of keeping up with the demand, so to speak. Again, reading from O Committee report, survey shows that during a six-year period, production created 9 million objects, or 1.5 million each year. Production could not dispose of the containers, which proved a bottleneck. However, that was almost 20 years ago. We suggest that vaporization techniques be employed to overcome the production problems inherent in King Alfred.
Vaporization, of course, referring to liquidation.
Yes, and referring to not being able to get rid of the bodies fast enough, basically, mm-hmm. to put it in simple terms. Again, we've gone through lengthy disclaimers of the King, of the King Alfred plan, but again, put into the context of...
Really contingency disclaimers,
yes,
I think, would be a
exactly.
good way of putting it.
But put into the context of what we know about Rex 84, what we know about Louis Jafrida's War College plans, then later updated by John Brinkerhoff, his deputy, Rex 84 and King Alfred begin to look more and more alike. All the time.
And again, the remarkable treatment, again, when Mae Brussel sent this to us, the very able and courageous researcher from whom we obtained this, the first copy was intercepted in the mail, never arrived. The second copy was intercepted in the mail and never arrived. The third one took a good 2 weeks to arrive, but to take a mail trip that should have taken a day or two at the most. And the fact that our network of informants has told us that this is, in fact, a real document, that John Williams was not able to come out and say so simply because of the controversial nature, led us to go with it at the time. We're glad we did, simply because now it is very obvious from the headlines that have emerged, this is a real policy. It is a real National Security Council contingency, and the similarity between the emergency, unquote, the 10 readiness centers, the 10 zones, and in particular, one wonders about King Alfred and Rex 84. It is our feeling that at this point, the undivided energies of those researchers who operate in good faith should be devoted to determining, among other things, just whether or not the King Alfred plan is in fact the groundwork for Rex 84.
I have a feeling, as a matter of fact, that if it is, if there are differences between Rex 84 as it exists now and what was the King Alfred plan, we will probably find that it was merely a slight shift in focus on the victims of the plan, and perhaps to include, again, as they mentioned, Central Americans considered to be dangerous, certain blacks, intellectuals, sympathizers, etc., perhaps not so specifically targeted at the, quote, the American Negro, the minority problem, as it would have been back in the late 60s and early 70s. So, but the substance very much the same, no doubt, and chillingly so.
Well, good evening. Welcome back once again, live in One Step Beyond. That, by the way, was once again from Radio Free America program number 32, originally recorded in September of 1987. Now, again, this is all in the context of what I'm afraid may happen in this country in light of its political antecedents and its political direction in the event of an economic collapse, and whether that happens quickly, as with the stock crash of 1929, or whether it happens gradually over a period of years or even decades. It is my fear that the economic crunch and the psychological and social dislocation will be alleviated by something along those lines. And again, as we contemplate Rex 84 and martial law, bear in mind my observation made first a number of months ago and earlier in the broadcast that the war on drugs involving not only the use of military units and National Guard units to patrol the borders, but more ominously, in my opinion, the use of Defense Intelligence Agency agents in order to conduct intelligence in Washington, D.C. in black neighborhoods. Well, it is now the observation of a lot of people that it's turning into a war on blacks, and whether that war on drugs to a certain extent represents a creeping King Alfred or a creeping Rex 84, it remains to be seen. However, bear in mind also that this country's antecedents, not only the industrialists and financiers who supported Hitler, but the
Nazi intelligencers, the thousands of SS men brought in at the end of World War II and put to work at the very core of our national security establishment, the Galen Organization that we've spoken about so many times. And last but certainly not least, the kinds of neo-Nazis one sees infiltrating the state defense forces, the kinds of people who, under the Rex 84 contingency plan, had been projected for deputization. And in fact, if you study our history, and one of the reasons why it's so important to study our history and to study the assassinations in this country in particular, those elements combined to overthrow the government on November 22nd, 1963. It may seem perhaps fantastic to people to contemplate a scenario like this happening. It appeared equally incredible to people in Weimar Germany. There were people like myself in Weimar Germany who warned about what was going to happen. They weren't dismissed as paranoids or conspiracy theorists. They were called alarmists or conspiracy mongers. Those were the phrases. And I think people should bear that in mind. Also bear in mind that our news media are not reporting really, really important things. They did not give a fair discussion of this country's political assassinations. They continue to dismiss that as the work of low nuts. Whereas if we go right to Volume 5, in the 26 volumes of Warren Commission testimony and exhibits, we see military intelligence units from Munich, Germany, being infiltrated into the United States in Dallas under the auspices of an organization called Conservatism USA. We see those military intelligence agents combining with organizations like the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, which in turn intersects heavily with many of the European fascists and the Galen organization in particular that we've spoken about. The ABN organization, like it, as we looked at in Radio Free America 15, neo-Nazis, as we looked at in Radio Free America shows 11, 12, and 13, the military per se, all combined to overthrow the government, and successfully so, in 1963, and yet nobody's talking about it. If they're not going to talk about that, it's a safe bet that in the event of a serious economic collapse, whether it happens gradually or whether it happens all at once, I would not count on those news media to tell you about what's going on. It should also be borne in mind, too, that one of the major Nazi tactics was something that they called salami taktik. That basically is derived from the notion of slicing salami. You take each step gradually. Each step is not very much worse than the step before, so the people do not protest. But over a period of time, with these gradual steps, you can move a great distance. The old adage about a journey of 1,000 miles beginning with a single step. Also, it should be borne in mind, too, that the auspices for the Rex 84 contingency plan were to be conducted under FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. The person just appointed head of FEMA in California was a fellow named William Medigovich, a former CIA agent who had not only lectured according to Ed Connolly, and I'm still waiting on those documents, who had not only lectured the state defense forces, but whose specialty was counterterrorism, quote-unquote. And that is not a very appetizing possibility to contemplate. It's also should be borne in mind, that in the event that there would be other ways than provoking an uprising by black militants or the excuse of social rebellion to implement martial law and conduct evacuations. And bear in mind William Bennett, the drug czar's proposal to relocate kids from inner city areas. Something like a natural disaster, an earthquake, or a nuclear accident, a chemical spill, that also could be used to evacuate people and to remove sections of the population. One of the things that should be borne in mind about the way the Nazis operated in their extermination programs is that entire neighborhoods, entire ghettos, were taken away at the same time. They were all herded on the train. The entire Jewish section of a particular city would be herded on the train at the same time, and they all went together. Also, generally, this didn't happen all the time, but often they were rounded up in the middle of the night. That made it that much tougher. Also, it should be borne in mind that in many countries, notably France, and there's a very good discussion of this in the book Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris, which elements of which are in the archives. I believe that's Grove Press, softcover edition 86, but I could be wrong on that. But certainly, The book Unhealed Wounds by Erna Paris goes into the discussion of how the French Jews were rounded up and sent to Auschwitz by the regular French gendarmerie. In other words, these weren't swastika Gestapo men, although there were some of them there. Most of the rounding up was done by the French milice, by the French police per se. So the people who may wind up, and in good faith, sending people to relocation centers, quote unquote, might be your local friendly cop on the corner. But it should be borne in mind again that when the Nazis rounded up neighborhoods, they basically were using a very, very important piece of psychology, because people tend to go along with what their neighbor's doing. They want to stick with the crowd. Conforming and conformity are major elements of our society, of socialization and social control, and most people are conformists. Most people are going along with the crowd, and that's one of the reasons why we haven't seen more protest about a lot of the shocking things that are going on, is nobody's standing out from the crowd. Everybody's going along and enjoying all the jive, whether it's The Simpsons or whether they're going out and watching video cassettes of Joe versus the Volcano. People are diverted and they're doing what their neighbors are doing. And it's important to understand that that is one of the reasons, one of the ways in which the Nazis were able to get people to go along. Now imagine, for example, if it's 4 o'clock in the morning and all of a sudden you hear a loudspeaker blaring outside, announcing that there's a nuclear accident or a chemical spill. And bear in mind, this is 4 o'clock in the morning and you're being awakened from a deep sleep. You're told, that basically there's been a nuclear emergency. Please remain calm, but you must evacuate. Proceed in an orderly fashion out to the vans. And this, of course, would be conducted by an officer or officers on a loudspeaker, either police or state defense forces or National Guard or whoever. And they could, many of them, be acting in good faith, not realizing what was going on. But you would be told that there had been a chemical spill or a nuclear accident, that the area was contaminated, and that you had to move immediately into the trucks in order to be taken to a safer area, to a decontamination center. Well, you basically have a choice at that point of going along with what everybody else is doing or making an independent decision. And if you wait that long to make an independent decision, it's unlikely, in my opinion, that you're going to be able to rebel against your social or one's social milieu, particularly if it happens at 4 o'clock in the morning. One's thoughts are going to be confused, you're going to be scared, you're going to be thinking about the safety of your family, trying to get the kids together or whatever. And, you know, up in Berkeley, they'll grab an extra fistful of alfalfa sprouts for good luck. But basically, people are not going to be figuring on rebelling at that point. If you haven't made your break with society before you get to the Birkenau railhead, you're going to go all the way to the end of the line. But conformity is a very, very, very important element in this whole scenario. You're going to go along with what everybody else wants and what everybody else does. That's one of the ways this thing is made to work. And again, imagine if you were all of a sudden awakened at 4 o'clock in the morning by someone announcing on a loudspeaker that there'd been a nuclear accident or a chemical spill or something of that kind, or if in fact there was an earthquake. Say the Hayward Fault went and Oakland was trashed, that would be a very easy way of relocating the largely black population of Oakland. And one can see very easily, say it's a nuclear accident, you're going to climb into the vans or the buses or whatever it is, and you're going to go, and you'll be taken to a decontamination center. And there you'll be told to, people whose last names begin with letters A through M, proceed to Officer Webley over here, or Lieutenant Webley, and people whose last names begin with letters M through Z, report to Lieutenant Johnson, and you will be told to take your clothes off, and you will be given some soap and a towel and be told to wash thoroughly and instructed, please proceed into the decontamination center. Wash thoroughly. There's nothing to be afraid of. There has been a nuclear accident. You have been exposed to dangerous levels of radiation. We're here to help you. Please proceed into the decontamination center. The people who got off the long, horrible, filthy plane or train rides to Auschwitz were dirty and they were told they were going to be deloused. They were being told that these were decontamination centers. That could very easily be adapted to the common scenario, and to the current scenario, I should say. And I think people should bear in mind that the desire to conform, the habit of conforming, because the vast majority of people do it. And again, I realize that this is a tall order of goods for people. It sounds incredible. It sounds horrible. But then again, you look at all the things that have happened. You take a look at AIDS, for example, and in Radio Free America 16 and its various supplements, we've developed very compelling information that, in fact, AIDS is a biological warfare experiment, specifically the application of genetic engineering to biological warfare. You look at the scores of thousands of Americans that have already died from AIDS, and there, basically, you're looking at what appears at this point very probably to be an example of U.S. government-inspired mass murder. And when you have political antecedents like the industrialists and financiers who supported Hitler, when you have people like the Galen organization, the SS men being brought in, when you take a look at the Republican Ethnic Heritage Association, which basically is a part of the Republican Party that concentrates on various ethnic groups, in particular Eastern Europeans, and in the fall of 1988 it came out that a lot of these people were former Nazis or former fascists, very close links to the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations. Many of them were war criminals. There were a lot of, there were stories in the major news media, and yet this did not affect American public opinion. The point being that these kinds of individuals, slaughterers, mass murderers, are not something that is foreign to the United States. And in fact, if you go back in history, this is a country in which the first 2.5 centuries or so of capital expansion were accomplished through slave labor and genocide, literally the liquidation of most of the native population. So these are not ethical considerations and political developments which are foreign to the American political psyche. And I'm afraid that in the desperate circumstances, which I feel would result from a major economic crisis in this country, and I'll say again, I don't think Americans have the mettle, I don't think they have the character to face something like that, I think it is quite possible that we could see something like this. I think it's also worth thinking about the extent to which our major news media have ignored certain very, very important stories, and that's going to bring us to the last tape segment of tonight's broadcast. This will go for about a half hour or so, and that'll leave us a little over a half hour for phone calls at the end of the program for those of you who would like to feed back on some of this information. We should have a little over a half hour for phone calls. I'm not even going to attempt to get into some of the other material that I had. We'll update that at some future point. Now, this following program, and this, by the way, this particular tape you're about to hear was produced for us by Eric Siegel up at his sister station KALX, which airs excerpts of these programs. And this particular program was produced a number of years ago. This is a tape of a press conference given by the late Representative Leo Ryan's legislative assistant, Joe Holsinger. He had a press conference on May 23rd of 1980, at which he spoke to people, representatives of a black psychological association, black psychologists, and he talked about Jonestown and the very firm indications that, in fact, Jonestown was a U.S. intelligence operation, and then when it was blown, those people were deliberately liquidated. And it's worth thinking about relocation in this context and ask yourself whether the same media voices that didn't cover this event properly in Guyana would cover it if it happened, say, in the middle of Wyoming or something like that. And bear in mind Representative Drug Czar Bennett's proposal to relocate kids from inner city areas that are beset by drugs, because these relocation proposals are ominously reminiscent of the relocation of those people who were considered undesirable by the Third Reich. So those of you who are taping, please get ready to do so. We're going to go for about a half hour or so. Here is Joe Holsinger.
Joe Holsinger.
Since I had appeared on a public television several months ago with a group of black professionals, mostly psychologists and doctors, they invited me to appear today to provide information that they thought might be, I might be able to help with this forum today, with their research. I appeared in Washington in February before the International Relations Committee and made some statements and some charges and documentation which resulted in the Foreign Affairs Committee, or International Relations Committee, whatever they call it today, They voted to ask the House Select Committee on Intelligence to investigate my charges. And they are currently investigating those charges by the House Select Committee on Intelligence.
Can you tell us what the charges are?
Well, the charges basically amounted to CIA contact with both the Burnham government there and with the People's Temple. That originally, it was my belief at the time I went to Washington that the purpose of our involvement there was to support the government of Burnham for commercial reasons, and they used the People's Temple almost as enforcers to help support an unpopular government there to keep control of the government of Guyana. We knew that there had been an article in the San Mateo Times in December of 79 which indicated that the deputy chief of mission there, Richard Dwyer, was in fact the CIA station chief. And he was the one that went to Jongsan with Leo's party, and he claimed to be slightly wounded, but there was a tape made at the time of the murders and suicides there with Jones yelling, "Get Dwyer out of here, get Dwyer out of here." And the indications are that it was Dwyer who went back into Jonestown after Leo was murdered and was there at the time. And there's great questions just who shot Jim Jones and why, whether Jones was shot to shut him up. The question also as to how all these people died and just when they died, which is all documented here. But soon I came back from Washington because of my testimony. I started getting documentation from a Berkeley psychologist called the Penal Colony here and from the Alliance for Preservation of Religious Liberty in Washington, which indicated other things, one of which was that George Philip Blakey was a top Jones aide. And he was the man who arranged the purchase or the lease of the land in Guyana, provided the money and arranged the lease down there in 1974. He also was tracked now as being a CIA operative in Angola in 1975 with UNITA. He's also the same guy who was a top aide who arranged all this purchase and the finances, is also the husband of Deborah Layton Blakey, who fled Jonestown and made those charges. He's a brother-in-law of Larry Layton, who was acquitted yesterday. And it's interesting to note the Peninsula Times Tribune says yesterday the jury acquitted. In acquitting Layton, the jury appeared to have agreed with the defense contention that Layton was brainwashed and drugged at the time of the shootings, could not be held criminally responsible. But the gist of what I'm getting to is this. I received a lot of documentation, which I will value to here today, that indicates the strong possibility that Jonestown and the People's Temple was in reality a mass mind control experiment conducted by the CIA as a follow-up to something called MK Ultra, which they conducted from the early 50s through 1974. They used to use the VA hospital and state hospitals. They used the federal and state penitentiaries for their experiments.
Do you think that Jim Jones was actively involved with the CIA?
I do now.
Would you elaborate?
Let me read you one quotation. I read this at the end. It's a quotation from the book, The Strongest Poison. But we had reports before they went down to Guyana that Jones had given $1 million to Burnham. There was another connection was between Burnham and Jones. We thought it was based on money. We don't know where Jones got all that money. We know, for example, that Jones spent at least 9 months down in Brazil, I think it was. It was either in the late 60s or early 70s, after which he came back with the money to start the Mendocino operation of the People's Temple. And we're starting to have the linkage between, we have Blakey, who was his top assistant, one of his top assistants, over in Angola with the CIA. We have Dwyer down there, the station chief of CIA. They had a covert operation. If they had to have with Dwyer, they had to have a covert operation, which was not reported to Congress. Now, the Hughes-Ryan Act of 1974 said they had to report all CIA covert operations to the oversight committees. That was Leo's legislation. He co-authored that. There was no such report of a covert operation in Angola, in Guyana, meaning, I brought this out in Washington, one of the things they're checking into in Washington now, that the CIA broke the law if it had a covert operation and did not report it to these oversight committees. So what we have here is, Leo goes down there, and the question is, with Dwyer there, and Dwyer came here from Thailand, he was with the CIA since 1959 in Guyana, We have photographs of Dwyer with his arms around Marceline Jones and Jim Jones out there. We have Jones. We have Dwyer going back to Jonestown after Leo's shooting, and Jones getting wiped out. And what we're trying to... We now have admission back to the Senate Intelligence Committee, for example, that they now admit that Dwyer, was CIA and is CIA. If Jones... What I'm doing is this. You're asking a question on CIA. And the definite involvement. They always deny it. They denied that Dwyer was a CIA agent when he first charged it. They now admit it. They only admit what you can prove. We have here a copy of a document called Who's Who in the CIA, one of these attachments here, listing Dwyer as CIA since 1959 and where he's been.
Well, let me get back to my original question. I asked you, since you made the statement that you felt the CIA was using People's Temple as an experiment.
My question was,
was Jim Jones aware of it? Was he part of that experiment?
If that experiment existed, because I'm saying to you that this possibly is a strong possibility. I'm inclined to believe it. I can't be sure, but I'm saying yes, that if such an experiment was there, Jones would have had to have been part of it and would have had to have led that experiment. Let me read to you this one statement from Jones, which is quoted in a guy, I hate to give you the source because it's the book The Strongest Poison by Mark Lane, and I know that Lane has lied in other parts of his book from personal experience. But there's a statement here, which you can read here, about Jones' claim that he was a true and loyal and patriotic American. It was a terrible shame he was obligated to remain in Guyana, and the world people would never know what a patriot he was. This is a statement from Jones, down in Jonestown. So what I would like to have you do, this is what I'm doing here, is very difficult for me to sort of shorthand this much documentation, but all I'm really doing is suggesting to you that I'm making this statement today to this forum. I've asked them to take the documentation I've attached to consider going in and viewing this data and conducting a further investigation on their own, especially in the black community, among survivors, among relatives of that, to see what elements they can find there, to cooperate or disprove these statements about the mind control experiment in Jonestown.
Do you see any significance in the fact that Jones did his recruiting and had his temple in the black community insofar as an experimental situation that the CIA might have been involved in his concern?
I'm not sure that he started there deliberately. I think it's possible, more likely, that he had something going already, a church going, and that if they were going to try to use cults or religious groups for this experimentation, they may have looked around for likely candidates who were already in action, already in operation. And they may look at somebody who was a charismatic leader type. And I don't think that he was started off this way. I think they may have watched his career and then decided to approach him. I think it would be more likely that he was already underway.
Do you have any conclusions as to how the people died in Jonestown?
Yes. I have part of our documentation here is a report from which is attached here. The chief medical examiner in Guyana is a Dr. Leslie Moto. He reported, and this is attached here, his opinion that more than 700 of those bodies found at Jonestown were not suicide victims, but were murdered. He based this on the injection marks in the upper arm. Page 4 of my statement here.
By injection, I guess?
Yes. And by gunfire. There were a lot more people killed by gunfire than they've ever admitted so far. We have heard reports that there were 50 of them, approximately 50 men with guns ringing around there so people couldn't get out. And very few of them did get out. So it's our according to the chief medical officer in Guyana, most of the people down there were murdered rather than suicide.
Who is suppressing all of this? Are you implying the CIA was active in the suppression?
Yes, I'm suggesting to you that a lot of things that don't make sense here. I'm suggesting that the long delay in anyone getting in, the press getting in there, or very many people all getting in there for several days, was caused by a deliberate attempt to manufacture the story, which has now been accepted and sold successfully to the American people.